Ashraf on September 13th, Pakistan time, 9 hours ahead of Washington. The meeting was a formal ritual of protocol where Chamberlain would present her credentials as the American ambassador. First on the list of demands was stop al-Qaeda operatives at your border, intercept arms shipments through Pakistan, and end all logistical support for bin Laden. In addition, American warplanes should enjoy blanket overflight and landing rights. The United States should have access to Pakistani naval and air bases as needed. Also, Pakistan should immediately provide intelligence and immigration information about terrorist suspects. Pakistan should publicly denounce the September 11th attacks and continue to publicly condemn terrorism against the U.S. and its friends or allies. ISI should cut off all fuel shipments to the Taliban and block all Pakistani volunteers from fighting in Afghanistan. Finally, should the evidence strongly implicate al-Qaeda, and should the Taliban continue to harbor bin Laden, Pakistan should break diplomatic relations with the Taliban and help the United States destroy Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network. Chamberlain departed the American embassy in a horse-drawn carriage. The pomp was part of the ceremony of presenting an ambassador's credentials. She clopped up to Musharraf's grand office at the Aiwani Sadr, the recently built presidential palace on Constitution Avenue. In Musharraf's reception room, Chamberlain read out the demands and asked, as she had been instructed to do, "Are you with us or against us?" She added, "Come on, General Musharraf, I know you are with us because we have talked." "I am with you and not against you," Musharraf said immediately, but rather than address Chamberlain's specific requests, he filibustered. He launched into complaints about American betrayals of Pakistan in the past. The United States had used Pakistan as a frontline ally against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, then abandoned the region when the war was won, leaving Pakistan with a massive burden of refugees, gun violence, and heroin addiction. "That's in the past," Chamberlain said. "Pakistan could now be either a clear enemy of the United States or a clear friend. If it became a friend, many good things could result," she said. Musharraf returned to his litany of complaints about America's unreliability. "I'm not hearing anything different from what you said before these attacks," Chamberlain said. "What do we need to do? We can help you get what you want. We need your help to get what we want." "It's hard for me to sign up to support a military operation that lacks any details," Musharraf argued. "I can't just send two brigades onto Afghan soil." He said he was willing to cooperate with the United States, but he would require help to explain his betrayal of the Taliban to the Pakistani people. Washington had misunderstood his position on the Taliban, he said. India was mounting a strong propaganda effort to portray Pakistan as synonymous with extremism. "Frankly, General Musharraf, I have not heard what I need to tell my president," Chamberlain finally said. "Well, we will support you unstintingly," Musharraf answered. Yet he needed to consult with his generals and cabinet before he could formally answer the seven American demands. Pervez Musharraf had a formidable ego. He was a Pakistani nationalist, but not especially pious. There was no suggestion that he had undergone a religious recommitment like General Mahmoud's. Indeed, there was little evidence that Musharraf sought a unity of the tactical and moral in his life. He seemed, above all, to be a tactician. He had been educated in Catholic schools in Karachi and spent much of his boyhood in secular Turkey. Musharraf had faced expulsion from the army as a young officer because of discipline infractions. He salvaged his career in the Special Services Group, or SSG, as a commando. He won a gallantry award during the 1971 war for operating behind Indian lines. As he rose to become a four-star general and lead the army as chief of staff, he did not take advice easily. He remained a risk-taker, but did not always win. In 1999, he had authorized a reckless covert invasion of Indian-held Kashmir by Pakistani soldiers disguised as guerrillas. The operation touched off a small war with India and failed utterly. That same year, Musharraf had seized power from Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in a coup d'état. General Mahmoud had secured Musharraf's coup by leading forces into the streets of Islamabad. Musharraf then appointed him to ISI. Musharraf presided over Pakistan as a military dictator that September, but he still required support from his fellow generals, particularly the 9 3-stars who constituted the corps commanders. They held direct control of the Pakistan Army's men and weapons. After putting off Windy Chamberlain on the 13th, Musharraf jawboned his generals and admirals, as well as his civilian cabinet, newspaper editors, and politicians, to prepare them for what he regarded as a necessary swerve in Pakistan's foreign and security policy. The essence of Musharraf's argument during these critical days was, if Pakistan did not manage this moment of crisis to its advantage, India would. Musharraf faced resistance from several corps commanders, however, and from Mahmoud at ISI. The dissenters believed it was unconscionable and dangerous for Pakistan to abandon the Taliban and align with the United States as it prepared to attack a Muslim country, an attack that would no doubt kill and maim many civilians. Musharraf tried to assure these doubters that he would preserve Pakistan's national interests, that he was only doing what was necessary. As he put it later, "We were on the borderline of being declared a terrorist state. In that situation, what would happen to the Kashmir cause?" The approach Musharraf sold in private was that he would tell the Americans, "Yes, but," as the Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid characterized it. Recalled Abdul Satter, then Pakistan's foreign minister, who heard Musharraf's sales pitch, "We agreed that we would unequivocally accept all U.S. demands, but then later we would express our private reservations to the U.S., and we would not necessarily agree with all the details." "The stakes are high," Musharraf told Bush over a secure telephone. "We are with you." Yet it was obvious from the start that Musharraf saw Afghanistan and al-Qaeda through his own prism. "In almost every conversation we had," Bush recalled, "Musharraf accused India of wrongdoing." Windy Chamberlain met Musharraf a second time on September 15th, this time at his home, Army House, the whitewashed colonial-era residence of Pakistan's top military officer in Rawalpindi. "Yes, but," was already in full swing. Musharraf's posture was, "I'm going to share with you my concerns, but these are not conditions." Chamberlain felt his caveats were not expressions of resistance, but gentle reminders of Pakistan's interests as it turned from ally of the Taliban to collaborator with America. On the Bush administration's demand to seal the Afghan-Pakistan border, Musharraf said, frankly, that was impossible. "The entire frontier corps is insufficient for such an operation," he said, referring to the tens of thousands of locally raised paramilitary troops that Pakistan maintained in forts and posts along the long mountainous border. "But we will try." Allowing American planes to overfly Pakistani territory would be no problem, Musharraf said. But he asked for the U.S. and Pakistani militaries to map out specific air corridors. "We are concerned that India might try to intrude into airspace the U.S. wants to use. We are sensitive about our nuclear installations." Musharraf said the United States should tell India to lay off and stay off. Musharraf had questions about what sort of war the United States intended to wage in Afghanistan. "Short and swift operations will be better than massive ones," he said. "Would the United States go after all the Taliban or just their leaders? It would be best to focus on just taking out terrorists like al-Qaeda." That, of course, would leave the Taliban, Pakistan's ally, largely intact. He suggested inviting Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the smaller Gulf states into the American-led coalition to fight the coming Afghan war. That would add other Muslim nations to the cause. "Neither India nor Israel should be part of any U.S. coalition," Musharraf insisted. "They are not friends of Pakistan." "India," he said at one point, "is not trying to help you so much as they are trying to fix us as terrorists." Also, Musharraf urged, Kashmir should be kept out of this. He urged the United States not to equate terrorism in Afghanistan with terrorism in Kashmir. Finally, Musharraf wondered what Afghanistan was going to look like when the operations are over. The post-war regime in Kabul must be a pro-Pakistan government that is inclusive of all Afghans. In the days ahead, Musharraf and Mahmoud advanced these talking points relentlessly in meeting after meeting with American officials. One theme was, the Taliban are not the same as Al-Qaeda and can be engaged or at least divided in service of American goals in Afghanistan. Another was, India is spreading lies about Pakistan, seeking to exploit your tragedy. A third went, the Northern Alliance created and led by Ahmad Shah Massoud, the CIA favorite, is made up of murderous thugs from the country's ethnic minorities and cannot govern Afghanistan. Musharraf considered the Taliban's emir, Mullah Muhammad Omar, to be a stubborn man with a tenuous grasp of international politics. Negotiating with him, Musharraf had found, was like banging one's head against a wall. Yet the broader Taliban movement was important to Pakistan, as the country's generals conceived of Pakistan's interests. Partly this was because the Taliban could be understood as an expression of ethnic Pashtun nationalism as well as of religious ideology. The Pashtuns were a tribally organized community bound by centuries of history along the Afghan-Pakistan border as well as by a distinct language. Throughout British imperial rule in South Asia, they had managed to preserve a sense of independence and autonomy, including the right to mete out their own tribal justice under arms, and the right to enforce their own socially conservative mores. Almost all Taliban were ethnic Pashtuns. The Taliban had captured and exploited the grievances and anxieties of Pashtuns during the brutal Afghan civil war of the 1990s. Pashtuns lived on both sides of the Pakistan-Afghan border. In Afghanistan, they made up about half of the population, concentrated in the south and east. In Pakistan, they constituted a minority of about 15%, but an influential and restive one. The future of Pashtun politics would affect Pakistan's internal stability, and the Taliban's outlook had become a part of Pashtun politics. At the same time, while the Taliban's Islamic radicalism might pose a revolutionary danger to Pakistan, it also intimidated India. That was another reason for Pakistan's India-obsessed generals to support the movement. The task facing Musharraf at that moment of crisis in September 2001 was not necessarily to preserve the life of Mullah Muhammad Omar, but to legitimize at least some Taliban elements in the eyes of the United States and the international community. Musharraf told Wendy Chamberlain at Army House that a post-war government in Afghanistan, in addition to being pro-Pakistan, should also be Pashtun-dominated. For two decades, ISI had tried to control Islamist Pashtun parties to influence Afghan politics. It was not about to stop now. Extremism is not in every Taliban, Musharraf told Colin Powell, as the American-led Afghan war neared. One knows for sure that there are many moderate elements. Case officers in the CIA's Islamabad station had been recruiting Taliban agents and contacts for several years, primarily to collect intelligence about bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. The agency's most active recruiter until the summer of 2001 was Chris Wood, a second-generation CIA officer. His father had risen into the senior intelligence service before retiring. Wood had started out as a teenager working at headquarters in the security section, watching janitors and maintenance men in the hallways to make sure they didn't try to steal any classified materials. He moved over to the agency mailroom while attending George Mason University in Northern Virginia. As a young officer, he learned Farsi, Iran's dominant language, a close cousin of the Dari spoken in Afghanistan. Wood worked Iranian operations for a number of years, but as penetrating the Taliban became a CIA priority in the late 1990s, he rotated to Islamabad, where he could use his Dari to recruit Afghan agents. He became renowned within the Near East South Asia division of the Directorate of Operations for taking a large number of hostile meetings, as they were called in CIA vernacular. These were meetings taken by career CIA officers with paid reporting agents or informal contacts, where it seemed possible that the individual might be armed and dangerous. Wood would drive a sport utility vehicle with the passenger seat unoccupied, and an armed colleague, a contractor or a fellow case officer, in the back seat, ready to shoot. They would wind through Islamabad, Rawalpindi, or Peshawar to an agreed-upon intersection, roll up to where the Taliban agent was waiting, invite him into the car, and drive away. From these tense, fractured conversations with informers, as well as less fraught meetings with anti-Taliban Pashtun activists and other local sources, the CIA had developed insights about the Taliban's leadership and its attitudes toward al-Qaeda. In 2001, CIA analysts reported to the Bush cabinet that the Taliban is not a monolithic organization, as then-Deputy CIA Director John McLaughlin recalled. Their analysis was, there are ideological adherents, but many others are with them because it is how you get money and guns. The logic implied by this conclusion was, there has to be a way to drive wedges in the organization. The CIA had identified individuals in the Taliban leadership who claimed to disagree with Mullah Muhammad Omar's policy of providing sanctuary to bin Laden and al-Qaeda because harboring terrorists deprived the Taliban government, formerly known as the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, of international recognition and aid. Bob Grenier was the Islamabad station chief, in charge of the CIA's efforts from Pakistan to split the Taliban and somehow capture or kill bin Laden. Grenier was a wiry, fit Dartmouth alumnus then in his late 40s. He was a forceful, clear writer who had studied professional management philosophies as he rose as a case officer into the senior intelligence service. After a long career, Grenier found the CIA could be arrogant, insular, and parochial, and while he enthusiastically shared that culture, he was also wary of it. He assessed himself as a contrarian. Grenier had wide field experience, but he had arrived in Islamabad in 1999 after holding supervisory office roles in Virginia for the previous 5 years. The September 11th attacks thrust Grenier into sudden prominence on the seventh floor as an advisor to Tenet in the White House on critical questions about which the Bush administration had scant expertise. For example, could the ISI be trusted for anything, and if so, what? To what extent should the United States accommodate Pakistan's demands as the war in Afghanistan unfolded? Could the Taliban be split or otherwise persuaded to betray bin Laden and al-Qaeda? Or should they be regarded as a unified enemy to be attacked without mercy or compromise? Grenier maintained channels to Taliban leaders. In January 2001, at a U.S. embassy reception, he had met Mullah Abdul Jalil Akhund, the Taliban's deputy foreign minister. Grenier had suggested they stay in touch and had provided Jalil with an Inmarsat satellite telephone. They spoke regularly. After the attacks on New York and Washington, Grenier called Jalil and suggested they meet in Quetta. Mullah Akhtar Mohammed Osmani, commander of the Taliban's southern zone, accompanied Jalil. Osmani said he had Mullah Muhammad Omar's permission to parley with the CIA to develop proposals that might break the impasse over al-Qaeda. They talked for hours, exchanging threats and proposals. Grenier suggested the Taliban could stand aside while U.S. forces snatched bin Laden. Grenier had no authority to make such a deal, but he was trying to develop a plan that could be presented to the White House as an option. The United States needed some kind of Pashtun strategy. An uprising, a deal with Mullah Muhammad Omar, some intervention closer to the heart of the Taliban-Al-Qaeda nexus than working with Ahmad Shah Massoud's surviving commanders in the Northern Alliance was ever going to provide. The most Grenier could extract, however, was an assertion that the Taliban would not risk the destruction of their nation for the sake of one man. Mahmoud Ahmed returned from Washington on September 15th. He had used his time to lobby the CIA's leadership for one last chance to persuade Mullah Muhammad Omar to betray al-Qaeda. In Bob Grenier, the ISI chief now had an ally. They met as soon as Mahmoud landed in Islamabad. Grenier provided a lengthy arm-waving account of his discussions with the Taliban in Quetta. Here was the sort of opening ISI had been hoping for, to preserve the Taliban without alienating the United States. Mahmoud said he would fly to Kandahar on the 17th to negotiate directly with Mullah Omar. No American accompanied Mahmoud, who provided nearly identical debriefings separately to Grenier and Dave Smith during the days after he returned to Islamabad on the night of the 17th. He said his talks with Mullah Omar lasted 4 hours. They were well acquainted with each other. To Mahmoud, Pakistan's core interests, managed through ISI, included the promotion of a peaceful Afghanistan and the reduction of poppy cultivation and heroin trafficking, which Omar had delivered. The Taliban controlled all of the country except a few pockets in the north, and drug production had been reduced. They had a basis for mutual confidence, in Mahmoud's view. Omar had sat on a large rectangular sofa at his pine-shrouded home on Kandahar's outskirts, with his legs pulled up and crossed beneath him. As they spoke, Omar picked at his toes. Mahmoud relayed the main elements of America's position. Bin Laden had to be brought to justice or expelled. The same was true of 15 to 20 other al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan. The Taliban had to close all al-Qaeda camps. Mullah Muhammad Omar might have 2 to 3 days to consider surrendering bin Laden. They had a detailed discussion about the possibility of bin Laden's expulsion. Omar said he could not hand over bin Laden to any non-Muslim authority, as Mahmoud, as a Muslim, well knew. The ISI chief tried a lawyerly argument. Prayer is an absolute obligation on Muslims, he pointed out, which cannot be avoided even on one's deathbed. Mullah Omar agreed. But what if a snake approaches while you are in the midst of prayers? The ISI chief asked. You abandon your prayers and deal with the danger first, and then resume your prayers, Mullah Omar answered. Don't you see this giant anaconda approaching Afghanistan? Mahmoud asked. He meant the United States. As emir of 25 million Afghans, is your oath of hospitality to Osama more sacrosanct than protection of your people? Mullah Muhammad Omar thought for a while, and then remarked that an assembly of religious scholars was to gather in Kabul the next day, and that the ISI chief should discuss the question with them. Mahmoud went on to Kabul. The assembly issued a statement to the effect that bin Laden was free to leave Afghanistan of his own free will. Mahmoud considered it a momentous concession, but it barely registered in Washington. To Smith and Grenier, Mahmoud reported that Omar had said the current crisis represented the will of God, and as for bin Laden, only his death or mine relieved Mullah Omar of the obligation to protect a Muslim guest. That sounded like the end of negotiation, but Mahmoud insisted that there was still reason to be optimistic. The United States has to give engagement with the Taliban a chance, Mahmoud pleaded to Dave Smith. The use of force should be an absolute last result. Maybe he has used me, but I'm happy to be used if it will avert a greater tragedy. The ISI chief added, I'm not a sleuth or a super spy. I'm a soldier, and I will fulfill the commitment made by the president, meaning Musharraf's promise to side ultimately with the United States if it came to that. On September 20th, President Bush addressed a joint session of Congress before a television audience estimated at 80 million. His National Security Cabinet and speechwriters had deliberated for 9 days about how to frame the coming war. Bush named al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden as responsible for the attacks on New York and Washington. The president explained that al-Qaeda enjoyed sanctuary in Afghanistan through its alliance with the Taliban. We condemn the Taliban regime, Bush said. It is not only repressing its own people, it is threatening people everywhere by sponsoring and sheltering and supplying terrorists. By aiding and abetting murder, the Taliban regime is committing murder. He continued, Tonight the United States of America makes the following demands on the Taliban. Deliver to the United States authorities all the leaders of al-Qaeda who hide in your land. close immediately and permanently every terrorist training camp in Afghanistan and hand over every terrorist and every person in their support structure to appropriate authorities. Give the United States full access to terrorist training camps so we can make sure they are no longer operating. These demands are not open to negotiations or discussion. The Taliban must act and act immediately. They must hand over the terrorists, or they will share in their fate. It was highly unlikely that Mullah Muhammad Omar could meet these conditions in a matter of days, even if he wished to do so. Al-Qaeda's brigades in Afghanistan were made up of determined fighters who would be no easy match for Taliban forces. On September 24th, Mahmoud rode to the American embassy to meet with Chamberlain, Smith, and a visiting Pentagon team that had come to plan for the war. They gathered in a conference room in the Chancery basement that had shelves of books about Pakistan. Mahmoud spoke forcefully and emotionally. "The Taliban are on the side of good and against terrorism," he declared. "You need the help of the Afghan people while U.S. forces are assembling. I beg you, I implore you, not to fire a shot in anger. It will set us all back many years. Don't let the blood rush to your head." "Mullah Muhammad Omar is frightened," Mahmoud continued. "Reasoning with them to get rid of terrorism will be better than the use of brute force," he said. "If the Taliban were destroyed, Afghanistan would revert to rule by warlords," he predicted. "We will not flinch from a military effort," Mahmoud promised, "but a strike will produce thousands of frustrated young Muslim men. It will be an incubator of anger that will explode 2 or 3 years from now." He mentioned Sun Tzu's aphorism about how the supreme art of war involved learning to win without firing a shot. Mahmoud added, "Whatever decision you take, Pakistan will stand behind you." "The most important sentence you spoke was the last one," Chamberlain answered. "The time for negotiating is over." The best-known ISI operator in the Afghan units of Directorate S was a Special Services Group career officer named Colonel Sultan Amir Tarar, whose nom de guerre was Colonel Imam. He had collaborated closely with CIA officers during the anti-Soviet war. He redirected his services to the Taliban after the Americans quit Afghanistan. Tarar was a tall man who kept a long, graying beard and professed a deep religious faith. He was also a raconteur who enjoyed talking about the glory days of killing Soviet forces. He openly admitted that he had worked with bin Laden during the 1980s. He found the Al-Qaeda founder rather like a prince, very humble. By 2001, Tarar served as Pakistan's consul general in Herat, Afghanistan, supporting the Taliban. He left Afghanistan early in October as the American bombing campaign neared. On his way home, Tarar ran into Grenier, the Islamabad station chief. They shared a flight to Islamabad on an ISI plane. Tarar wore a Taliban-style turban of the sort bin Laden often wore and spoke excellent and colorful English. Tarar presented Grenier with a Special Services Group pin as a memento. The CIA station chief found Tarar to be marvelous company. He did not hold out any hope that they could work together on bin Laden, but he was familiar with ISI officers who hated American policy but got on well with American counterparts. Once back in Islamabad, Colonel Imam sought an appointment with the Taliban's ambassador to Pakistan, Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif, an old friend and war comrade of Mullah Muhammad Omar's. Zaif received the ISI veteran at the Taliban's embassy. After they exchanged greetings, Imam started to cry. Tears ran down his face and his white beard, and he could not speak. When he finally composed himself, he said, "Almighty Allah might have decided what is to take place in Afghanistan, but Pakistan is to blame. How much cruelty it has done to its neighbor, and how much more will come." The colonel laid the blame on Musharraf. He started to cry again. He said he would never be able to repent for what Musharraf had done by aligning himself with the Americans. He would suffer not only in this world, but in the next. This was ISI in microcosm, an institution well practiced at manipulating the CIA and the Taliban simultaneously. From the very first days after September 11th, the United States adopted an ambiguous policy toward ISI that would haunt its ambitions in South Asia for years to come. "We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them," George W. Bush had declared. It was an emotionally satisfying position, but was it realistic? Bush's doctrine might be applied easily enough to the Taliban, a ragtag force that eschewed modern technology and had no air defenses or air force of significance. But how should it be applied to Pakistan, a nuclear-armed, highly nationalistic country of 150 million? Hadn't Pakistan harbored the Taliban? And didn't its desperate effort to prevent the movement's destruction signal that Pakistan's interests might not be aligned with those of the United States as war in Afghanistan unfolded? Bush's National Security Cabinet included experts on Russia, missile defense, military modernization, and the Middle East. It included nobody who knew Afghanistan well, however. Powell and Armitage had worked closely with Pakistan's military during the 1990 to 91 Gulf War to expel Iraqi forces from Kuwait, a war in which Pakistan had participated as an American ally. Powell respected Pakistan's army and was sympathetic to Musharraf's pleadings. President Bush, for his part, concluded that by turning on the Taliban, however ambivalently, Musharraf was taking large domestic and political risks on behalf of the United States. He therefore deserved support and understanding. There were pragmatic reasons for the Bush administration's restraint that September and October. The most important purpose of American military action in Afghanistan would be to assault al-Qaeda's leaders and guerrillas, to disrupt any additional terrorist plots against the United States that the group might have underway. Bin Laden's strongholds lay mainly in Afghanistan's south and in its eastern mountains. The seaports and air bases Musharraf offered the United States would make a war in Afghanistan much easier to fight than if the United States relied on more distant India, which had also offered basing support. Al-Qaeda was the main enemy, and there would be time later to reconsider ISI's role in destabilizing the region. A shocked world had rallied to America's cause against bin Laden. The war was coming. "Don't let the blood rush to your head," Mahmoud Ahmed had advised, self-interestedly. It was too late. Chapter 4. Risk Management. Mullah Muhammad Omar spent his boyhood in Afghanistan's destitute Uruzgan province, raised by an uncle who was an itinerant religious teacher. His father died when he was very young, and his mother married the father's brother. He belonged to the Hotak tribe, a marginalized clan with little purchase on southern Afghanistan's power or resources. The farthest Omar ever traveled was Pakistan. Apart from Quranic studies, he had no formal education. He possessed a rural mind, as one of his more widely traveled Taliban colleagues put it, cut off religiously and politically. After the Soviet invasion, as a teenager, he joined a group of insurgents he knew from Kandahar's madrasas and preaching networks. They fought in the irrigated desert west of Kandahar City, around Maiwand district. One day on the battlefield, the Russians pushed forward, and Omar and his comrade Mullah Abdul Salam Zaif could see them from their trenches. The area was covered with corpses. The Russians lobbed in shells. Shrapnel struck Omar in the face and wounded his right eye. That night, the Afghan comrades held a marvelous party, in Zaif's description, and Omar, his face bandaged, sang a ghazal, or traditional poem. "My illness is untreatable, O my flower-like friend. My life is difficult without you, my flower-like friend." Omar never regained the use of his eye. After the war, he retired to a home without electricity near a mud-walled mosque in Sangasar, near the battlefield where he had been wounded. He took four wives, raised many children, preached, and studied Islam. Afghanistan collapsed into civil war after the Soviet withdrawal. Criminals, predators, and warlords ruled Kandahar, extorting citizens and truckers at a maze of checkpoints, or kidnapping boys into sexual slavery. Omar's wartime comrades decided to challenge the abusers. They required a leader. A committee arrived one evening at his home. The members explained to him that they had picked him. Zaif watched as Omar hesitated, seeming to think before saying anything. It was one of his habits. Finally, Omar said that he agreed with what the committee proposed. Something needed to be done. As he created the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan with support from the ISI and Saudi Arabia, Omar surrounded himself with religious advisors and military commanders almost uniformly educated in rural Pashtun villages and madrasas. Searching for a purity of life partly drawn from village norms and following religious instruction to imagine life as it prevailed in the 7th century during the Prophet's lifetime, they evolved or invented a public Islam whose specific rules had an otherworldly character. An official Taliban gazette published a week before the September 11th attacks clarified the following list of items formerly banned in the Islamic Emirate. The pig itself, pork, pig fat, objects made of human hair, natural human hair, dish antennas, sets for cinematography and sound recording projectors, sets for microphotography, in case it is used in the cinema. All instruments which themselves produce music, such as the piano, the harmonium, the flute, the tabla, the tambour, the sarangi. Billiard tables and their accessories. Chessboards, carom boards, playing cards, masks. Any alcoholic beverage. All audio cassettes, video cassettes. Computers and television which include sex and music. Centipedes. Lobsters. A kind of sea animal. Nail polish. Firecrackers. Fireworks for children, all kinds of cinematographic films, even though they may be sent abroad, all statues of animate beings in general, all sewing catalogs which have photos of animate beings, published tableaus, photos, Christmas cards, greeting cards bearing images of living things, neckties, bows, the thing that strengthens the necktie, necktie pins. Omar was an unusually tall man. He could be reticent and refused to meet most non-Muslim visitors. He sometimes cited his dreams in explaining his decisions. He saw his earthly life as a fate he did not control fully, and he referred continually to God's will. Bashir Nuruzai, an opium smuggler from Mullah Muhammad Omar's home district who supplied money and arms to the Taliban during the Islamic Emirate, believed that his leader had one characteristic. He was very stubborn. His attitude was that he knew better than anyone else. Now, power also makes one knowledgeable. He was an ardent Islamic rule enforcer, yet he was not an ascetic zealot. He listened to Pashto folk songs on cassette tape. Apart from his exceptional height and his commitment to wars of resistance against non-Muslim invaders, Omar had little in common with Osama bin Laden, who had grown up privileged and exposed to cosmopolitanism in booming Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Omar was a few years younger than bin Laden. He had not invited the Saudi to Afghanistan. Bin Laden initially entered Afghan territory not controlled by the Taliban in a chartered jet, carrying cash and a following of fighters. Mullah Muhammad Omar received him in Kandahar and gradually forged an alliance. The Taliban needed al-Qaeda's shock troops against the Northern Alliance. Omar also accepted bin Laden's financial largesse to improve Kandahar. Yet there were tensions between them over bin Laden's provocative media interviews and the terrorist attacks al-Qaeda carried out abroad, which brought the Taliban under tightening diplomatic, economic, and travel sanctions. No Taliban or other Afghans participated in the September 11th attacks. The hijackers were Saudis and other Arabs. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the plot's mastermind, was a Pakistani who had lived for many years in Kuwait and attended college in North Carolina. It is not clear whether Mullah Muhammad Omar knew of the conspiracy in advance. Two European scholars who interviewed Taliban leaders extensively judged it doubtful that he did, but could not reach a firm conclusion. Hank Crumpton at the CIA's counter-terrorist center had come to believe that Al-Qaeda, if anything, had co-opted the Taliban leadership and had taken advantage of their stunning ignorance of world affairs. Still, under the emerging Bush doctrine, Omar's refusal to cooperate in bin Laden's arrest condemned the Taliban to mass slaughter and indefinite imprisonment as enemy combatants. And the Taliban leader adamantly declined to yield. An edict issued in Mullah Muhammad Omar's name 8 days after the attacks on Washington and New York required all offices of the Islamic Emirate, in addition to being ready for sacrifices, to begin holding Quran reading sessions in their mosques and ask a great God for humiliation, embarrassment, and defeat of the infidel powers. Mullah Zaif had served Mullah Omar loyally as a minister and then as ambassador to Pakistan, the Taliban's most important diplomatic post. After the September 11th attacks, he traveled to Kandahar. Omar told him that he had summoned bin Laden and asked him about the attacks on New York and Washington. "He swore that he didn't do it," Omar explained. "I couldn't pressure him beyond that. If you have proof of his involvement, then show it to me. But I haven't seen any proof." In Omar's mind, there was less than a 10% chance that America would resort to anything beyond threats, Zaif concluded. The Taliban leader clung to his position that bin Laden had not been proven guilty. "Where is the evidence?" And, "If there was a crime, we are not supporting the criminal." So there was no reason for the United States to target the Taliban. Zaif predicted, America would definitely attack. Other Taliban leaders advised that even if Mullah Muhammad Omar produced bin Laden, the Americans would still strike. The demand for bin Laden, they argued, was just an excuse to overthrow the Taliban's Islamic State. A Taliban editorial published on September 23rd posited that Osama is a good pretext for the United States, which had colonizing objectives and was interested in establishing a military base in Pakistan at any cost in order to control this region. In Mullah Muhammad Omar's advisory circle, they believed that power had been given to them by Allah, and that at any time Allah could take it away, said a former Taliban foreign ministry official then in Kabul. They were thinking, if Allah is not with us, then we will lose power. Conversely, if he is with us, we can defy the world. The air war opened on the night of October 7th in Afghanistan, the afternoon in Washington. At the CIA, the center of action was the Global Response Center, the counter-terrorist center's 24-hour operations room on the sixth floor of old headquarters. Video screens hung on the center's walls. Officers and analysts, many from the agency but some on assignment from the military, sat before classified computers and secure telephones. The atmosphere was alert, but quiet. The operators mainly communicated by typing messages in a secure chat system. George Tenet arrived at the center for the war's opening. Charles Allen, the CIA's assistant director for collection, who had helped develop the Predator drone program, turned up as well. As CTC director, Kofor Black was the commanding officer in charge of the CIA's drone operations, which had recently acquired lethal capability. Predators and similar drones had been providing low-altitude aerial surveillance for the CIA and the military for a number of years. The CIA had been operating Predators on surveillance missions over Afghanistan out of an airbase in Uzbekistan since the summer of 2000. The classified program was experimental. The ability of drones to hover over terrorist camps in otherwise remote and inaccessible territory gave rise to the idea that they might be equipped with weapons. A CIA Air Force team, known most recently as the Summer Project, had modified the drone's capabilities rapidly. The latest innovation, perfected over the summer, had been to equip Predators with Hellfire air-to-ground missiles that could strike buildings or vehicles. On September 17th, President Bush had signed a Memorandum of Notification authorizing CIA covert action against Al-Qaeda and its allies, including targeted killing. Bush delegated the trigger-pulling decision to Tenet, who delegated it to the CIA Directorate of Operations, which delegated it to Black. Under the Counterterrorist Center's command, pilots had been flying Predators armed with Hellfires over Afghanistan for several weeks. But the CIA had refrained from shooting at any targets because doing so might risk exposing Uzbekistan's secret cooperation. Now, under the cover of a wider air war carried out by conventional American bombers, starting this night, the agency could fire when ready. Yet Black did not have authority to order Air Force or Navy bombers into action. That decision belonged ultimately to General Tommy Franks, the 4-star general and career artillery officer who ran Central Command. That afternoon in Langley, the Global Response Center's screens showed infrared imagery of Mullah Muhammad Omar's home on Kandahar's outskirts. A CIA-controlled drone transmitted the live video feed. It was a dark night in Kandahar. The drone sending the pictures was one of a small number the CIA had put in the air over Afghanistan after September 11th. The pilot and sensor operator controlling the flight sat in a metal container elsewhere on the CIA campus, near a parking lot. Scott Swanson, a former Special Operations helicopter pilot, had the stick. The sensor operator was Jeff A. Gunny Gway, an Air Force imagery analyst. Omar's Kandahar compound was a well-known surveillance target. CIA-directed pilots had been flying over the home regularly since 2000. The house was one of the few obvious targets known in Afghanistan, as a senior officer involved put it. The CIA had placed the Emir's compound on a list of targets for Central Command to bomb after September 11th, but it was up to Tommy Franks to decide what to strike first this night. Osama bin Laden and many of his al-Qaeda lieutenants had already fled to the White Mountains along the border with Pakistan, according to the CIA's reporting. Yet Mullah Muhammad Omar had stayed put at his comfortable home in Kandahar, which had been built and decorated by bin Laden as a gift. Some officers in the CIA's leadership hoped Central Command would bomb the compound in the very first strikes of the war to eliminate Omar and his lieutenants. Instead, following more conventional doctrine, Franks approved initial bombing on October 7th of an airfield in Kandahar. Air Force doctrine typically sought to eliminate the enemy's air defenses in the initial strikes, so that U.S. and Allied planes could fly and bomb at will after that. The Taliban's air defenses were rudimentary, but Franks took the standard approach. The problem was, the initial bombing of the Kandahar airfield effectively announced that the American air war had begun. As a CIA Predator watched overhead, several turbaned men soon emerged from Mullah Muhammad Omar's house. The Taliban climbed into a pair of vehicles and drove away. The CIA Counterterrorist Center's analysts judged that Mullah Omar was in the group. The intelligence case was multiple-stream, authoritative, comprehensive, in the assessment of a senior officer involved. The CIA-directed Predator followed the small convoy. The vehicles drove initially to a home in downtown Kandahar that the CIA had previously identified as the residence of Omar's mother. The men entered, stayed a brief time, and then left. This time, they departed Kandahar and drove about 40 kilometers to the west of the city. They arrived at a compound that contained 2 1-story flat-roofed buildings separated by a rectangular open area about 100 yards long and 50 yards across. One building appeared to be a madrasa or Islamic school. The smaller building across the yard appeared to be a mosque. The presumed Taliban, possibly including Mullah Omar, went inside the school. There were other armed men and vehicles present. Later, participants would retain diverse memories of the number of presumed Taliban gathered, from a relatively small number to several hundred. During the next several hours, the decision-making about whether to attempt to kill Mullah Omar, or more precisely, the group of men that had emerged from his house and was judged to include him, became badly confused. The Predator's infrared cameras showed glowing images of distinct individuals but could not provide photographic clarity. This was a novel interagency operation in which a top-secret CIA drone program was attempting to coordinate its action with Air Force decision-makers who sometimes didn't even know that the CIA had a live camera on the target. Air Force imagery analysis was at its best when tasked to identify enemy tanks in open areas on a conventional battlefield. Collaborative analysis with the CIA about men out of uniform hanging around on the outskirts of Kandahar challenged the Air Force's standards of risk management. The 20-pound Hellfire missile the CIA Predator carried had been developed for Apache attack helicopters to penetrate tanks and kill their occupants. Its relatively light explosive payload would be ineffective against a large roofed building like the school the presumed Taliban had just entered. The alternative was to drop conventional bombs, each with massive destructive explosive force, compared to a Hellfire missile. Air Force and Navy fighter bombers were now circling outside of Kandahar on standby. They carried such ordnance. The CIA's Global Response Center had an open line to Central Command's Joint Intelligence Operations Center in Florida. CIA officers talked with Brigadier General Jeff Kimmins, the Director of Intelligence, or J2, at Central Command. Kimmins was sitting inches from General Franks in a small, secure room on the second floor, watching the same infrared Predator footage as the CIA's leaders. There were 8 to 10 intelligence officers, operations officers, and analysts in the Central Command operations room, as well as a Navy captain who was a military lawyer or judge advocate general. She was there to advise Franks about targeting rules. In larger adjoining rooms sat dozens of other Central Command officers and targeting analysts. The CIA requested a conventional bombing of the madrasa, where it appeared Mullah Muhammad Omar had entered. A Central Command intelligence officer present said years later that he did not recall that request, but even if the CIA had asked for such a strike, he would have advised Franks against dropping bombs on the target. The reason? When someone enters a building, you don't just strike and kill everybody under the assumption that they're all Taliban. Bombing the presumed school with so many unidentified people inside would have been irresponsible. Also, Central Command's on-site lawyer, the JAG, concluded that the nearby mosque would be damaged unacceptably. The scene required tactical patience, as the military intelligence officer put it. We were not eager to do something foolish and kill lots of innocent people. That mattered a lot to Franks. The military was not out to kill Mullah Muhammad Omar at all costs. We were intent on killing him at a time and place where we could do so surgically. Moreover, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Tommy Franks had orders from President Bush to minimize collateral damage and civilian deaths during the air war, to avoid inflaming Afghan and international opinion. In his final conversation with President Bush, Bush had told Franks that the war was not about religion. If you see bin Laden go into a mosque, wait until he comes out to kill him. Now, as he watched the compound, Franks thought, wait till they come out. Franks relayed to the CIA that he had decided not to bomb the school. An Air Force officer monitoring the events made notes of his reaction to this decision. Sink, Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM, that is, Franks, not hitting building because of collateral damage. Amazing. We could get Omar, but the Sinks worried about collateral damage. The CIA initiated an appeal, according to several officers involved, to ask Rumsfeld and ultimately President Bush to overrule Franks. But it would take an hour or so for that request to play out. Black and the CIA team running the Predator operation inside the Global Response Center still had an opportunity to fire a Hellfire missile, even if the missile was not potent enough to take out the school and kill all the men inside. Nobody had ever fired a missile from a remotely operated drone on a battlefield. They would make military and intelligence history if they did. An officer watching the Predator feed at Langley figured there would be a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about whatever the CIA did now. The feeling in the Global Response Center was, have to be correct. Don't mess it up. Kofor Black could have fired legally on his own authority. Yet Central Command's senior intelligence officer had just announced that there was an unacceptable risk of collateral damage. Officers watching the CIA feed recalled that the Global Response Center asked for permission to shoot at a pickup truck parked outside the assembly building. The purpose was psychological, according to an officer involved. They would stun the Taliban. In Florida, Franks thought that maybe a hellfire shot will persuade the people to leave the mosque and give us a shot at the principals. The Air Force officer keeping notes recorded Franks' logic. Perhaps use hellfires to scare them out to go to another hold site and then hit them. Black gave the order. In the container on the CIA campus, Swanson now counted down. "Weapon away," he said. The hellfire missile fired off its rail. A truck exploded in a flash of light. The Taliban in the flat-roofed building did indeed rush out. They took up positions in a standard 360-degree infantry defense. The glowing infrared figures were all adult males, some carrying weapons. There wasn't another target like that for the rest of the war, in the judgment of an officer watching. The men drove off. They did not all go in the same direction, however. Swanson and Gway directed their predator above one vehicle that they believed held Omar. There are two credible accounts of what happened next, drawn from the memories of participants. In one account, Central Command ordered the CIA to return to watching the original school compound. In the other, the Predator followed the vehicles to a new compound with a mosque. It is clear that at some point, Franks spoke with Rumsfeld about whether to risk collateral damage by striking a mosque, given the possibility that they would kill Omar. According to a memo Rumsfeld composed 2 weeks later, the Secretary of Defense instructed Franks to wait a few minutes. Then Rumsfeld called President Bush to inform him. Bush concurred that the risk of innocent deaths or destroyed mosques was worth bearing if Mullah Muhammad Omar was in their sights. Rumsfeld relayed his own approval to Franks without telling him that he had spoken to the president. Finally, on Franks's order, American fighter bombers deposited two bombs on the mosque under CIA surveillance. In any event, Mullah Omar was not there. The CIA later assessed that after he departed the school west of Kandahar, he made his way to Gardez, in eastern Afghanistan. So far as is known, no other significant Taliban leaders died in the bombing on the first night of the war, either. Mullah Muhammad Omar's death on October 7th might have influenced the Taliban's evolution, given the divided opinions within the movement's leadership about how to manage their relationship with al-Qaeda after the shock of September 11th. That alternative history might have turned out no better than what actually unfolded. But as the coming decade's failures and suffering unfolded, the lost opportunity of October 7th gnawed at several of the military and intelligence officers involved that night. They wondered, from time to time, what might have been. The hunt for Mullah Omar went on, but it seemed to be cursed. In one instance, recalled Robert Grenier, then the CIA station chief in Islamabad, our best human source in Kandahar provided a precise account of Omar's movement in a small convoy, but when Islamabad station put the target information out within minutes of our receiving it, the station got no response from headquarters. The CIA and ISI also apparently tried to track Mullah Zaif in the hope the Taliban ambassador would lead them to Omar. As the air war intensified, Zaif traveled to Kandahar in a land cruiser to discuss with Omar an offer Qatar had made to mediate an end of the fighting. He was followed all the way by Pakistani intelligence. He made his way to a makeshift Taliban headquarters in Kandahar and asked for Mullah Omar. But he was not there. Zaif left. 1 hour later, a U.S. Air Force strike destroyed the building. The Taliban emir had trusted his fate to Allah. It would be obvious to him how to interpret the outcome. His role on this earth was incomplete. He told Taliban colleagues, according to one of them, "It is very strange that I am not greedy, for I know my power, my position, my wealth, and my family are in danger. However, I am ready to sacrifice myself, and I do not want to become a friend of non-Muslims, for non-Muslims are against all my beliefs and my religion. He said he was ready to leave everything and believe only in Islam and in my Afghan bravery. We are living in decisive days that will give rise to a manifest victory for Islam and its people, if Allah wills. He prophesied in a letter he wrote that autumn. We will not submit nor become lenient. The full moon of victory has appeared on the horizon.